I can listen with my whole body and not be told I'm being too sensitive or too imaginative. It's just what's real.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. There's a term that I frequently hear, and that term is your third eye. Some spiritual practices consider your third eye your intuition, your inner voice, or even your higher self. Well, my guest today has written a book called Third Ear, Reflections on the Art and Science of Listening. Her premise is that hearing is science, where listening is really an art. For her, caring and listening are one and the same. Our conversation today may change how you experience the world around you, literally how you listen to it. Elizabeth Rosner is an author, a poet, and has been teaching creative writing for over 30 years. She is a Stanford graduate, has an MFA program at UC Irvine and the University of Queensland in Australia. She has written 3 novels as well as some nonfiction works, Third Eye being one of them. Elizabeth has national awards and recognition. She has been interviewed by the New York Times and NPR. Her writing has appeared in New York Times Magazine, Elle, The Forward, and The Huffington Post. I welcome the opportunity to explore the concept of listening with more than just your ears.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for taking the time to join me today.
Hi, Barry. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. So are you in Marin today?
I'm in Berkeley.
Oh, Berkeley. Okay. Wonderful. Yeah. I love Berkeley. What a great place. Yeah. So now you are a novelist and a poet and a teacher. So you've written, is it true? You've written, I think I read 5 books, 3 fiction.
Six.
And 6 books.
6, yeah.
6 books. And some were nonfiction and then some were. And then you have a few that are fiction as well, right? Your first novels.
Yeah. So I started out with 3 novels and a poetry collection. And then my 2 most recent books are nonfiction.
There seems to be a theme in your books. Like even though they're fiction, there's some historical things and the characters. So what are the themes and what made you pick those topics?
Well, it's interesting. You know, at the time, I was sort of aware that I was working on certain themes that recurred, but I don't think of my books as sequels to each other in any
right.
way. It's just that when I look back across all the genres, I feel like I tend to focus a lot of my attention on what we carry, whether genetically or emotionally or even in the form of stories that we carry. And so I would say the neatest way to say it is I write about intergenerational inheritance of trauma and resilience.
So, yeah, that is an interesting theme. And your parents were both Holocaust survivors, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that trauma is passed through DNA as well as through stories and living with people?
I've come to really be convinced of that. I know there's still some debate out there in the biological world or in the people who really study genetics, but I would say that even as a child, I understood that there were things I felt and was aware of that hadn't been communicated to me verbally or even behaviorally. It was just something I kind of came into the world knowing. And now we have a name for that. We there is this language we use for epigenetic inheritance, which actually technically isn't DNA, but it's the expression of DNA.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that we have sort of scientific evidence to support it, I feel more validated because as a kid, I was often told that I was just being too sensitive or I had too vivid an imagination. Whereas I feel now there's a lot more understanding that this is real and it's shared not just among descendants of Holocaust survivors, but across many cultures and histories.
For you, is it when you write about it, even if it's fictional and with fictional characters, is it healing for you? Is it help you move to a new position?
I've really been a very strong advocate for the notion that speaking about and naming what we carry is really helpful in lightening the burden of it or transforming it and healing it. But I also don't like to oversimplify that, because I think that in our culture, there can be this commitment to talking about everything. And if you don't talk about things, then they fester somehow. But I think it's a very individual choice. There are a lot of people for whom talking about trauma is re-traumatizing. And so I think it depends a lot on the context. It depends a lot on the person and a lot on the way you're being held or supported through that process. But for me, absolutely, yes. Writing, sharing, hearing from other people about what resonates with them, it's been very healing for me, sure, yeah.
Now, do you have children yourself?
I do not.
So I was just, I was wondering.
I'm an auntie.
Do you feel like, I wonder, do you have a feeling that as generations move forward, the trauma that's passed is lessened by the work that we do on ourselves?
You know, that's a great question, because I think it's really actually complicated. I feel like every answer to your question is, it's complicated.
I know, yeah.
So. Yeah, but I think that, you know, for some people it's lessened, and for some people it's actually in some ways increased, because sometimes the people who lived through the trauma are the ones who have developed the most sturdy coping strategies. And then the next generation is the one kind of wrestling with unresolved trauma that they just got given, or it, you know, was sort of transmitted to them. And then the third generation deals with the stuff that the second generation couldn't address. And so sometimes it can even be amplified for a while or magnified in a different way. I think what it does do is it changes. And I think that change is somewhat unpredictable, and yet there are patterns that get noticed generationally.
I think it's a really good point that I think we all individually find ways to work through it. I don't think you can be a human and not deal with trauma in some form, some more extreme than others. But, you know, for me, like in the morning when I journal, that's a good way for me to get it down on paper and then, you know, maybe get it out of here for a little while. But I think everyone has different ways to cope.
And, there are people who use movement and no words at all. You know, there are people who use the visual arts. There are people who use drama. There are people who use relationships with animals. You know, I mean, there are just so many approaches. And for a lot of people, I think it's also trial and error. You know, it's not necessarily immediately obvious what's going to work for you.
Yeah, I don't want to say I'm one of those people that actually use my personal relationships at times.
yeah, that sadly. Happens. You're not alone.
I do want to talk to you. I love your latest book. It's the third year, right? It's Reflections on the Art and Science of Listening. So is it the third year? Is it a little wordplay on the third eye?
You know, when I first came across this book by Theodore Reich, who was a protege of Freud's, and his book was called Listening with the Third Ear. I had never heard that notion before, except that, like you and a lot of people, I had heard of third eye. And so it just made me incredibly curious, because we all know there is no such thing as an organ that's a third eye. It's a metaphor, it's metaphysical. And so I think what I began to get excited by was the concept that listening had a similar kind of metaphoric quality, but also a beyond the body, you know, a full body and also beyond the body.
What was the catalyst that made you even look for a book like that?
You know, I was working on a novel after I wrote my previous book, Survivor Cafe. The subtitle of that is The Legacy of Trauma and the Labyrinth of Memory. I thought I was going to go back to writing fiction. And I had a character who I imagined had been in analysis with Freud in Vienna. And I realized I needed to do a lot more research about what that might have been like for her. And then I discovered this book title, and it was like this giant, you know, left turn, right turn pivot for me. I realized that I was so intrigued by this inquiry, what is a third ear? How have I experienced listening with a third ear? not just in a therapeutic context, but in throughout my life. And it really did connect with everything I'd already been writing about and thinking about, because so much of what my life has been like as a daughter of Holocaust survivors and also a teacher and a human being really mm-hmm. has been about listening not just to what people are saying, but what they're whispering or what they're not even able to find language for. And then also my curiosity about listening in the natural world. I used to spend a lot of time in the woods when I was a child. And I think that was really a very healing and consoling place for me, as well as being in water. And so I started really thinking back to what were my experiences of listening that made me feel more connected and less alone. And so that was what I really was trying to explore in this book.
The third eye is about your listening to your intuition, maybe, and mm-hmm. your heart. So mm-hmm. is the third ear a similar thing?
It can be. I think it's also, you know, when Reich wrote about it, he was saying that the analyst or the therapist has to be paying attention not just to what's being said in the room with the client or patient, but what they aren't saying, and also what's being felt on the inside. So it's both external and internal. It's that movement back and forth. It's self-awareness. It's self-attunement. Mm-hmm. It's attunement to vibration or sensation that is more than just a literal frequency. I mean, hearing, the reason I said, you know, reflections on the art and science of listening is that there is a mechanism through which we hear. You know, you can measure all of that and you can study the workings of the body and the inner ear. But I'm really fascinated, like with third eye, about what is the mystery of that? You know, what is the interpretation that we give to what enters us through our ears and through our skin and through our hearts and through our, as you said, our intuition? You know, how do we hear things that we don't really hear technically, but just know.
Right. Now, and I don't know if I read this in your book or a quote from you where hearing is a science and listening is an art. Mm-hmm. So that means we all hear because we're scientific, like we're set up anatomically to hear, but listening is it a learned skill?
Well, you know, it's the first line of the book because I really think that that's sort of the ground for this whole conversation and my whole investigation exploration was it's like the difference between looking, you know, you're just looking, you're using your eyes, they're shifting around, you focus on things. But when you're observing, that's a whole other level of attention that you're giving. Same with smelling versus trying to identify a scent. Or touching something versus palpating when you're trying to really feel beneath the surface of something. So the idea that if we're lucky, we can hear, you know, not all of us are fortunate. And I write in the book about losing hearing in my right ear. I haven't lost it entirely, but I'm losing some of it. And so, yeah, that's something that can be measured according to scientific rules and convictions and principles. But listening is, I don't know that we learn it exactly. It's that we develop our interpretations over time. Mm-hmm. They become story. They become understanding. They become a feeling of connection and attunement with, or reaction to, you know, sometimes we recoil from a sound and there's something both really, you know, kind of mechanistic about that. Certain sounds hurt, but then there are other sounds that we have associations with that are painful. And that is definitely something learned.
I have been in meetings or seminars where something's said and everyone hears what is said, but people's interpretation of what was said is different. So that's based on their background and their interpretation of what is being said.
I think that's a great example that we could literally all write down the same words or even a piece of music. It doesn't even have to be language. Mm-hmm. It can be a song even without words. And yet what we experience physiologically, emotionally, what kind of memory it brings up, or what kind of harm we might feel from words. You know, right now, it's a great opportunity for mm-hmm. us to notice how triggering certain words are for entire groups of people. And we have to understand that it's not the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. That you can use a word or a phrase and think we all agree on the meaning, but in fact, that third ear listening varies a lot.
And it kind of maybe it goes back to the thing you said about epigenetics. And it's like mm-hmm. what each one of us is passed down with mm-hmm. internally might affect what we're listening to or how we're listening.
Absolutely the case. I think that especially when it comes to trauma, since we've been, you know, mentioning that a lot, our traumatic residue, whatever that might be, mm-hmm. whether it's a legacy of lineage or something in our own lifetime, cues us up to listen in particular ways. Sometimes mm-hmm. we're listening for danger. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. we're listening for something uncomfortable or something reassuring, and mm-hmm. that's going to vary depending on your experience mm-hmm. and your expectations. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what is some of the research you did to write your book?
Oh my gosh, a ton.
Yeah, well, maybe a couple examples.
Well, you know, of many things, you know, as I said, there's both a lot of human story in the book and a lot of more than human story in the book. So mm-hmm. some of my most interesting research was about people who work with horses with equine therapy mm-hmm. and the ways that horses' ability to listen is phenomenally sensitive, and mm-hmm. they're listening in a way like we are with their entire bodies, not mm-hmm. just with their ears. And their field, their like energy field, is considered to be 8 times larger than ours. So research into that was mind-blowing mm-hmm. and really intriguing because, you know, horses are being used with children on the spectrum, nonverbal children. Relationships that children can develop with these horses is profoundly transformative for them. And also with veterans of war who've been traumatized by their military experience, horse relationships can be really healing. And I'm not talking only about riding horses. I'm talking just being around mm-hmm. horses, being in connection with them. I also loved the research that I did far afield, something in Japan. It originated in Japan at the home of somebody who had lost a relative to cancer, and he installed a disconnected telephone on his property so that he could imagine speaking with this lost relative on the telephone. And when the tsunami, I can't remember what year it was, but recently this terribly damaging tsunami hit that coast of Japan, people started flocking to his phone to use it to communicate with their grief. It was a way that they could work with their grief over these losses. And they called them the phone of the wind. Wow. And these phones are now set up all over the world. People have imitated this. And this idea that, you know, a lot of cultures believe we can still communicate with the dead. Mm-hmm. But this idea that, you know, our addiction to telephones and our belief that phones are the way we stay connected, mm-hmm. this idea that a disconnected phone can console us in the deepest way. And for me, that means that the wind itself can help us feel our third mm-hmm. ear. You know, this idea that through the air, through the molecules of the air, we can imagine we're still in contact with anyone mm. and everyone. Those are just two examples.
That's a beautiful example. Mm-hmm. I love your horse example too, because I have seated trauma because I've had like 3 broken bones in my lifetime, and they're all off of horses.
Oh, ow.
When I was a kid and once in my mm-hmm. early 20s. And now mm-hmm. when I go near a horse, even it doesn't have to, I can just be by a corral and a horse mm-hmm. will start acting up. The person's like, I don't understand. And it's because it's sensing mm-hmm. this energy field from me because I'm it's that trauma still left inside of me from that. It's interesting, right?
Fear is such a powerful energy, right? It's energy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a vibration, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm,
There was something else that I read that you, with whale earwax, what is the, I found that interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are still so far from really appreciating and understanding whale communication and what whales are, you know, themselves and in relation to us. But, you know, one of the things I felt so astonished by my own, like somehow I had forgotten that mammals, including whales and dolphins, are mammals that were on land and returned to sea during the process of evolution. And so, of course, our connection with them is quite literal, really. Mm-hmm. We share a lot of qualities in terms of how we parent, how we communicate with our offspring. And yet whales are also really sensitive for such giant beings. They're very, very sensitive. And so studying, it turns out that their earwax, and I really don't even know what whale earwax looks like. So I'm going to have to, like, some of us are going to have to go do some research after this conversation and look up an image. But their earwax actually stores evidence of their cortisol levels, which are their stress hormone levels. And so researchers have been studying this residue to see how traumatized have whales been over the course of a lifetime, because we know that sound underwater can be really impactful and harmful to these mammals. And so the study of their earwax, it's like studying fossil remains or something. It shows the history of their exposure to stress.
Wow.
And it's like us. I mean, stress gets stored in our body. I don't think it gets stored in our earwax, but it gets stored in all kinds of places, in our tissue, in our bones, and now we know, essentially, in the expression of our DNA.
My name is Andrew. I'm one of the full-time instructors here at Rancho La Puerta. I've been here for a couple of years now. And one of the things that has been incredible for me getting to be a part of this community is just the healing nature of this space. There's something deeply spiritual about just the campus, the ranch, the hills around it. I lost my son about a year and a half ago. Tragically, he was only 12 days old, and it was a tough time for my family and I. And I'm very grateful for being able to be a part of what's happening here. Everyone, from guests, fellow staff, incredibly supportive, incredibly kind. And I truly believe that, like, walking the hikes in the morning, like, saved me after that experience, because it just gives you space to process, to feel, and to ask the questions, and, you know, even have amazing conversations. There's one guest in particular that I had a couple conversations with over the course of his stay here, one of the presenters, and shared a number of pieces of wisdom from his tradition that really helped kind of settle some of those doubts and some questions and find some meaning and purpose in that. So the ranch is truly a very special place. I'm sure guests say that all the time. But when it comes to grief, it really is this kind of wave or this unexpected visitor that you don't know when it's going to come. You don't know. You can't predict it. It hits you. And so being in a space like this when you're experiencing a loss of any sort, of any kind, the peace that surrounds you gives you that feeling of safety to be able to explore that grief, to name that grief, and to walk through it, not only in what needs to be done in that inner work, but with people who are surrounding you and just showering you with loving kindness. So that's what I could say about the ranch.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I hope you are enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. So now you interviewed people also, professionals,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
in different walks of life. Mm-hmm. And what did you learn from them?
Again, just such an array of fascinating yeah. people that I was able to learn from. I'm thinking a neurolinguist, Marion Biorica. She was telling me about the multilingual brain and the developmental advantages of speaking more than one language, not just bilingual, but multilingual speakers. All the ways that you can have different kind of personality traits in different languages that you speak. I'm sure mm-hmm. anyone who is listening to this and who speaks more than one language can identify with that. I, for example, am more playful in Spanish because my Spanish isn't perfect. And so I'm kind of sometimes using like poetic words rather than the actual correct mm-hmm. word. I grew up listening to 6 languages spoken in my family. Well, my mother spoke 7. Wow. 3 of them she shared with my father. And so I didn't understand those languages, but I listened to them like music, kind of. And so I've always been really fascinated by the multilingual brain and how that affects us, developmentally in childhood and also in adulthood. I interviewed people who were podcasters like you, interviewed people who specialize in listening to people's trauma. I interviewed people who are improvisational musicians mm-hmm. and drama therapists and, I could go on. A lot of people.
Was there any commonality through all the people that you interviewed about their thoughts on listening?
That's a great question. I think that, the theme that I mentioned earlier as the theme running through all my books, intergenerational trauma and resilience, I would say that the other common thread is the longing to connect. And I think that is something that came up in almost every one of my interviews, that whether I was talking to somebody about equine therapy or their study of dolphin communication mm-hmm. or trees and how trees, mm-hmm. Network in the forest, it's that networking image, that connective mm-hmm. tissue, that way that we're trying to make contact with each other. Mm-hmm. The Voyager spacecraft that we sent out into space with a set of messages from Earth, we're trying to connect all the time. And I think we're trying to receive connection too.
You said you grew up in a household, you said, where there was 6-7 languages spoke mm-hmm. and you couldn't understand mm-hmm. all of them. And I was somewhere recently where there was so many different languages being spoken around mm-hmm. me all the time. Mm-hmm. And I still feel on some level that I could understand the gist of what was happening, even though you don't understand the language, because there's so much mm. more going on than the sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that growing up too?
Yeah, the story that I tell very close to the beginning of the book is my earliest memory of sound. Mm-hmm. And it was when I was about 3 and my parents were whispering in what I later found out was Swedish. Swedish mm. was one of the languages they shared because they had been refugees after the war ended. They both ended up in Sweden for different mm. reasons. That's where they met and fell in love. And I could feel the texture, the tone, the emotion of what they were saying, even though I didn't know what the words meant.
Mm-hmm.
But I really wanted to know. And so I love what you just said, that when we're really tuning in below words, mm-hmm. which we have to do if the words don't make sense to us, we have to use our other mm-hmm. strategies, right? So you're talking really about 30 or listening when you say that. You're mm-hmm. you're watching body language. You're feeling, is there tension mm-hmm. in the air or is there warmth and love and mm-hmm. right. generosity of spirit in the air?
Right.
So I think that's a great example of how we can listen below words and around words.
As I studied, my master's work is in journalism, and mm-hmm. I love words. And Miguel Ruiz has that book, The Four Agreements. I'm sure you've seen it. But the mm-hmm. first agreement is be impeccable with your word. Mm. And I think the words are so powerful. And I think that I've learned over the years to like shut up as much as I can, because most of my communication is in the listening part, I think, you know?
I love that. I love that, Barry, because we forget how rich and valuable silence can be, mm-hmm. you know, so much of the time. And again, this isn't a how-to book. It's not really any kind of advice giving or instruction, mm-hmm. really. But I do hope that one of the takeaways that people will feel from the book is the power of silence, even in dialogue, in conversation,
right.
to wait and let somebody's words really enter you before you jump in with your response.
Right.
To give people space and
right.
and allow a silence to occur as a way of showing respect, really.
Right. One of my dearest friends is an artist, and when she teaches people to draw, if they're looking, let's say they're looking at a leaf, she teaches them to draw all the space around the leaf and not the leaf. And then the leaf comes forward. And I think, and it's a weird analogy, but I feel like listening is a little bit the same way. If you listen to all the stuff that's going on around the word, that you can maybe listen deeper, I hope.
I love that analogy. I mean, in art, even in movement, they would call that negative space. And
right.
I think, you know, speaking of power of words, we have such a weird association with the word negative.
Negative, yes.
But what she's doing is making that positive, right? Putting your
right.
attention on it. And so, you know, another thing that I write about in the book, in various parts of the book, is Quaker practice. And I'm not a Quaker, I'm not in any way an expert on Quaker practice, but I'm really intrigued by the devotion to silence in Quaker practice. And there's somebody I quote in the book who said, I can't remember his name, but he said, I speak two languages, English and silence.
Yeah.
That it's a language, you know?
No.
So
no,
rich.
I think it's beautiful. Maybe now this is maybe a little bit more of a personal question. What made you decide to write this book?
You know, there are so many decisions that go into writing a book. It's such a commitment, right?
Mm-hmm.
It takes years, literally. In this case, this book took me 5 years to write. And after I finished writing Survivor Cafe, I was feeling really drained in a lot of ways by, I had immersed myself in studies of trauma and also what could heal trauma, how were people addressing trauma. Mm. And on a lot of levels, I was feeling the need to focus on something and think about something that felt more uplifting in a way, even though I believe that, yeah. as we said earlier, writing about trauma in itself can be healing and transformative. Mm-hmm. But there was something about listening and the subject of listening that kind of lifted my heart, you know, mm-hmm. and made my spirit feel a little more joyful and a little more hopeful. And I know that I myself feel, and I think probably a lot of people feel right now, that we need places to put our attention that bring us hope and that mm-hmm. and that make us believe more fully in the possibility of our unified field, you know, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of what Third Ear Listening, I think, has to offer is, as I said, this way of connecting that goes beyond who's saying what to whom, or mm-hmm. you're not just walking through a forest or walking alongside a body of water. You're listening to it. You're receiving it. You're allowing mm-hmm. those connections to affect you and hopefully bring you a sense of closeness and intimacy.
So listening is like, it's more like, it's like a whole body, whole soul experience.
Yeah, I'm glad you use the word soul. I think sometimes we're afraid of that word, but
yeah, then people are kind of afraid of that word, you know.
So
someone asked me the other day, "Do you believe that there's souls, and if everyone is connected to the same soul?" And I mean, it's a question that, you know, but
you know, I think that, again, going back to sort of art and science as side by side, I mean, so far, science can't measure the soul, but art is all about soul, right? And and we know soul when we experience it, when we feel it, when we recognize it in another being, not just a human being, but another being. You know, anyone who's ever looked into the eyes of a dog or a horse or, you know, even a bird.
Right. I mean, you get it on a level that you can't really explain sometimes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There's so much that really is beyond words, beyond language. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And now you teach writing. Do you still teach?
I do. For years I taught at universities and colleges. I had tenure at a community college for many years and taught writing and critical thinking and literature. And now I teach in my living room, and I teach at places like Rancho La Puerta when I'm lucky.
Yeah.
And I love the short-term teaching practice that I'm able to do. It's a bit of an immersion practice, and it's wonderfully gratifying. Not that I didn't love teaching in institutions, but there's a lot that goes on at institutions that can be not teaching. It can be sort of the opposite of obstacles to teaching. Right. So I like having my my autonomous teaching practices. And a lot of what I do is I teach listening. I teach listening. Yeah.
I do know in undergrad, my favorite class I ever took was creative writing. Mm. And my teacher, she was so great. She would be, she's like, I'm not going to give you a grade. How can I judge you on the creative? And then when I ended up in grad school in journalism, every paper I got back had a zillion red marks on it because, you know, just, it was like, it wasn't about listening. It was about hearing and putting down on paper just the facts, which sometimes don't tell the story of what it really means.
Yeah, there was this one week I taught with a journalist. I co-taught a workshop with a journalist, and our teaching styles were so different. Right. She was just looking to get in there and cut and slash and change and fix, and I was kind of stunned because for me, it's so important to not just be gentle, but to really try and understand what the person's trying to do and say. Mm-hmm. And like you say, that involves listening on my part, helping them listen to themselves.
Yeah.
And so it's a really different approach. And she would literally say, you know, in journalism, you just don't have time to talk about what the good stuff is. You just have to go right after the things that need fixing. And That was revelatory to me. So my style of teaching is very supportive and very, very much focused on attunement and creating an environment in which that piece of writing can find its own way of being in the world. I know that sounds kind of abstract, but I'm quite hands off for a long time with writing as a teacher. Yeah.
Well, I think there's more abstract things in this world than there are things that you can put your finger on, to be honest.
That's exactly what we're talking about, right?
If you could have a dream for the people that would read your book, what is your goal? Why did you put this message out there? Why do you want people to pick this book up and read it? I mean, I want everyone to read your book for sure.
Thanks, Barry. Thanks for saying that. I think the greatest gift I've received so far from people who have been reading it and listening to it, because I narrate the book in the audio version. If you want to be read to by me for 8 hours, you can get the audio. People who have said to me that they felt like their way of listening had changed as a result of reading the book. That this one woman described being at the pool, where I know her from a swimming pool that we both go to. And she said, I got in the water after reading your book and I suddenly was listening to the sounds of the water in this new way. And And that she felt like her nervous system was changed because of that. You know, I think that, you know, there are so many things that people can learn from the book or take away from the book. Mm. But I think on some level, it can be at the soul level, like we were saying, mm-hmm. you know, what are you allowing yourself to feel and let in from the world? And what are you allowing yourself to know about things you've always known and felt, but weren't supposed to know or weren't allowed to say were true? And a connection with your animals, a connection with the forest, a connection with birds, a connection with the wind, you know, to feel like, oh, somebody got me, somebody gets mm-hmm. me, you know, and this is real, this is true. I can listen with my whole body and not be told I'm being too sensitive or too imaginative. It's just what's real.
That's beautiful. So, well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope that I will get to take one of your classes at the ranch in the future. So
I can't wait to come back. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, my God. It's been my pleasure. We need more people like you on this planet.
Oh, right back at you. Thank you. Okay.
Today's conversation was in greater depth than I had anticipated. Elizabeth has a calming and authentic way of sharing. She opened the possibility that trauma may be passed down from generation to generation, and there is hope that we each can find ways to lessen the impact it has on our lives, not by denying it, rather by recognizing and developing coping skills. We then got to explore the listening aspect of communication on a level I had not considered. Our world feels overwhelmed by noise. There's digital static, political clamor, and the constant hum of anxiety. Relief may come from not adding more sound and noise. Instead, perhaps we can learn to listen differently. Our world needs more listening to one another, more listening to the environment we share with one another, and perhaps even more listening on a cosmic and spiritual level. I invite you in to tune in with not just your ears, but with your full attention. That's a lesson I'm taking away today. Until next time, this is Barry wishing you health and daily joy.